Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by dogs. Dogs, over 100 years of success. My name is Aaron. I'm here with my personal pals, Brick.
Woof.
And calling in from across the pond, Nico.
That's me. Hello.
Personal pal, Dave, is out on assignment.
Dave died.
Oh, okay. That was the assignment. Yeah, he was murdered.
His assignment was to no longer live.
Well, he's doing a great job.
He will be back for Halloween when we resurrect
him. Oh, zombie Dave.
Yep.
That's exciting.
Yeah, we'll have a Conjuring tonight.
This is our regular What Are We Reading episode. Time to check in and see what the personal pals have on their nightstands, their reading lists, their, audio, audible cues, whatever you call that. Brick, you have some books in front of us. What are those books?
Hey, you made me go first?
I do.
All right. I'm narrowing down what I'm sharing this time to not just list off everything I've looked at in the last few months.
Sure. We should say this is the fiction episode. So we're talking about the books we read that are in sort of the fiction.
Strictly fiction.
Yeah,
this is fiction. So
no truths, only lies.
Indeed. I chose two World War II anti-war novels.
Mm.
Last time I recorded and recently put on the Patreon, if you've got a chance to listen to it, we went through the 100 best books, I believe, of the 20th right. century. It didn't actually say that, but I don't think there was any 21st century books on that list.
No, that list was written in 1999, I think. Or 2000.
Oh, that list was? All right. Yeah. So we went through the 100 best books, and as we came across it, we all kind of started talking about Slaughterhouse-Five, and yeah. I mentioned I really ought to reread that because I hadn't read it in a very long time.
Yeah.
So I reread Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, and it's a wonderful book.
Yeah. So your previous, you liked it before, you enjoyed it when you read it as a kid.
Yeah, I loved it when I read it as a kid. Yeah. I read it again, I don't know, like 10 years ago.
Okay.
Still liked it, and now I also still like it.
Anything different now, or deeper resonance?
Yeah, it might just be because I'm older.
Mm.
It kind of made a little more sense. It's not as funny
now.
I mean, it's still funny, but it's more like that kind of funny, you know?
Right.
Where you're like, oh, this is deeply sad.
Yeah, we talked about this recently in the humor episode about how Vonnegut is not laugh out loud funny. It's more wry funny and kind of sad funny almost.
Yeah, yeah. I also spend a large percentage of my life working with people with PTSD, and this book seems to really encapsulate that pretty good.
Mm.
And the way he uses time travel to kind of mirror that is quite effective.
Yeah.
And the book's pretty pointed about it. It starts in the beginning talking about how it's pretty hard to write an anti-war novel because the idea of war is so just fucked.
Right.
That, like, one, obviously war sucks, but two, unless you experience it, you have no idea.
Hmm.
And even if you do experience it, trying to, like, compartmentalize that somehow, then go and live a normal life is, like, it's just absurdity, right? So then Billy Pilgrim lives this life where he just gets unattached in time. So sometimes he's in the war, and sometimes he's in the future, and sometimes he's in his childhood, and it all kind of bounces around.
Mm.
And I think that does a pretty good job of just highlighting just how insane it is to expect a human being to be able to like, live those two lives concurrently.
Right.
When was it written?
Oh, man. 50s, I want to say, yeah, I was going to say 59.
I mean, it's based on his own.
Right.
69.
Okay.
That is pretty crazy.
That's later than I thought it would be. Yeah.
Yeah, that is.
Nice, right, guys?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Aaron, drink.
Yeah. I will now stand by my decision not to give it any boners on that.
Yeah.
On that list we did.
Montana Wild Hack.
This is probably his best book.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite of his books.
Right.
Though it is very, very, very good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is really a book that pretty much everybody should read.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure if it's still assigned regularly in high schools or not. I imagine I've never taught it. I imagine it's difficult to teach.
I would say so. I imagine this mostly shows up in like supplementary reading lists of like, if you want to read further, like here's some good ideas.
If you haven't had enough school yet and you want to do some shit on your own. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably still
in
an AP list.
In fact, that's probably how I read it the first time.
Me too, for sure.
Yeah. I don't think it was a book that the whole class was assigned.
No, I did a report on it, but it was do a report on a book of your choosing.
Yeah.
From this specific list.
My final note here is just so fucking good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you should read this book. And then this other book takes a very different approach to the same sentiment.
Yeah.
I had never heard of this book nor this author.
Yeah.
And this book is called The Painted Bird by Jerzy Kosinski.
Mm-hmm.
Nico, have you heard of this?
No.
No, me neither. So I got bored in New Hampshire. So I went to a bookstore And I wandered up and down. There's only like 2 aisles of books. And I wandered for a while. I just couldn't find something to read. So then I grabbed this and I was like, this looks doable.
Yeah.
And then this book kicked my ass. It's great. It is one of the most disturbing books I've ever read.
Huh.
Like to the point where I don't even really want to tell you what happens in one of the chapters. Maybe I'll tell you off mic. But
yeah.
So basically it's a story about in the onset of the war, this family is displaced and they hire this dude to like smuggle their kid across Europe.
So which war?
World War II.
Okay.
I can't, either the guy bails or dies or something. So it's just this kid trying to survive and kind of moving village to village in like Eastern Europe.
Mm.
I believe he's 10. And then I don't think he's actually a gypsy, but he looks like one.
Okay. So many.
He says gypsy.
Oh, okay.
In the book. But again, I don't think he's actually, I think he's just dark-eyed, dark-haired, so everyone kind of assumes he is.
Right.
So it's more or less episodic, where each chapter is kind of something that happens, a little vignette in a different village, and then it ends with him leaving that village and going to the next one.
Hmm.
Occasionally, the chapters kind of connect, but more often than not, it's almost like connected short stories. And some of them are brutal. There's a lot of murder. There's a lot of rape. There's a lot of cruelty. There's a lot of like extreme violence.
Yeah.
But it's never in a way that, it's meant to horrify you.
Right.
And this book, I think, I've been very concerned lately with the state of our current political climate and how some things that I find enough to make me want to start killing people have just become normalized.
Right.
And it upsets me greatly.
Mm.
And it's interesting to see something taking place kind of in a world where that has already spilled over. And it was also a nice reminder that the parallels are not exact at all. Like the lives of the average poor person in Eastern Europe in 1941 or whatever were fucking miserable.
Right.
Like just miserable. And then there's a lot of superstition in the book, which if you have a miserable life and you like can't really eat and you're freezing to death all the time and you're sleeping on the ground in a village while soldiers are constantly coming in and stealing your women and children or whatever.
Right.
Like that's no way to live. And you're going to start developing superstitions because it's the only way to make sense of a senseless world. Right.
Right.
But then just how like, showing like oppressed people, then pushing even further harm on less powerful people as a ripple of just fucking evil that really washed through. And I have no idea how much of this is accurate, but I'm willing to bet that most of these things or things like it probably occurred in some way.
Right.
Just atrocities. So it's really good. If you guys are interested, I'll tell you off mic about some of the things or make you read them, but they're like, it would probably get us flagged for obscenity. So I won't do that. The only other thing, it really reminds me, and I wonder if this was an influence. Apparently this is an influential and popular book. Again, I've never heard of it. It reminds me a lot of The Road.
Oh, interesting.
By Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
Obviously came first and is based in reality, whereas that one's not.
Right.
But I wonder if he had, that dude seems like he reads a lot of books. So he probably had. But I wonder if he had this in mind when he was writing that book. Because it follows a similar structure and thematically, obviously the scenario and setting is different, but thematically it's pretty similar.
Right.
You're saying you wonder if Cormac McCarthy had it in mind?
Yeah.
When was that written then?
Late 90s, early 2000s. No. Was it that late?
I want to say like 2008, 2009 maybe.
Wait, which book? Really? I mean,
I thought I read that in college.
The Painted Bird.
Maybe I read it at, maybe.
Oh, Painted Bird.
This came out in, I'm sorry, in the 60s, I believe.
Oh, okay.
65.
Oh.
Yeah, The Rose says in 6.
Really? That's later than I would have guessed. So I guess I didn't read in college. But either way, this is 50 years ahead of The Road. And The Road's a very good book. I'm not a huge Cormac McCarthy fan, but I liked that book a lot.
Right.
This is maybe one of the best war books I've ever read.
Wow.
And I'm doubly happy about it because I had no idea what it was, and I literally just picked it randomly off a shelf.
Right.
And it's like a pretty ugly cover. It's not that great.
Yeah, that screams late 90s, early 2000s paperback. It's really terrible design.
It's also super shitty quality, and you can tell it's on like one of those like it's kind of blurry, and it's on one of those like on-demand print press things.
Oh, yeah.
Huh. Painted Bird by Jerzy Kosinski. Prepare yourself for a deeply unsettling read.
Yeah.
But it's like pretty powerful.
Yeah. The name is familiar, so when you brought that up, I was like, yeah, I know that name, but I don't know why. I never heard of The Painted Bird before, or certainly hadn't read it, but I just looked it up real quick, and Jerzy Kosinski wrote the novel Being There that the movie is based on, and that's how I knew of him from that Hal Ashby movie with Peter Sellers, but the butler who's like a savant, basically. Have you seen that movie?
I have not.
Oh, it's great.
What's it called? Being Dead?
Being There.
Being There. Okay.
Yeah. It's Peter Sellers, it's like one of his last movies, maybe, or his last big role. I think he either won or was nominated for an Oscar for it, I think. Huh. But yeah, interesting.
Huh.
Good. Nico, what about you?
I've got a couple of normie fiction books.
Okay.
Well, I guess one is technically nonfiction, so I'll toss that one out. And then there's one called Normal People that was written by an Irish woman, and it takes place in Sligo in the tiny little town where I live. And it's like a pretty big book, which is weird.
Big in terms of heft or like popularity?
Popularity. Like, it's definitely big over here. I don't know how big it is. But it was like final in a couple of awards, and I think it's won a couple of awards.
Huh.
But it's just about these kind of two people in this small town in Ireland, and they grow up knowing each other, and like it's a guy and a girl, and like they have kind of a super weird relationship and then it takes place over the course of like 20 years. And it starts out with their teenagers and they're fucking, and then the girl is like, are you going to invite me to prom? And he's like, no, I'm not. Like, I'm not going to acknowledge our relationship. And then that kind of informs their relationship for the next 20 years.
Huh.
Yeah. And then it's got a lot of kind of small town Irish life.
Right.
Which is interesting to see kind of on the bigger stage. And then another one's called Recursion by Blake Crouch, which is a time travel book.
Okay.
It's kind of a semi-technical time travel book. So then, like, people discover that this time travel machine that lets you basically transport your consciousness back into a memory that you have from your own life, and then you go back into your life, but just your consciousness, kind of.
Like a quantum leap, but for yourself.
Yeah, and then once you get back to the point where you transported, then everybody else remembers the life that they used to have before you transported yourself.
Huh.
And that becomes a big deal. It was pretty good, but then it was like a really good idea, and then it was pretty clear that he didn't have anything to do with it.
Oh, like there was no consequences or... Right.
Well, it was just, there weren't any complications, you know? So like the second act of it was very repetitive.
Right.
And then they kind of tie it up with a bow in the last 10 pages, and it's like, all right.
Right. Well, what was the point?
Right. It was like, what's the point of that second act, except that you needed to have your book be 300 pages to sell it.
Right.
They literally do the same thing over and over again for, I think, 100 pages.
Right.
Because like, they just can't figure out how to fix everything. Mm-hmm. And then in the last 10 pages, they're like, oh, that's how we fix everything. But it's like there's kind of like super weird kind of set pieces. One part, you can go back into your life. And so this man and woman who then start like a romantic relationship, and the woman is the one who comes up with the time travel machine. The man is just like a dude. He's a police detective. And he, so then they keep going back and trying to, like, spending their entire lives trying to figure out how to solve the problem. And so then at one point, and then literally, like, their entire lives, they know the point. It's like April 16th, 2019 at 10:42 a.m. Everybody's going to realize what we've done all of a sudden.
Right.
And then literally, like, at a certain point, people start dropping nuclear bombs on each other as soon as they realize what's happened. They know that. They know all that. They know all that for 40 years. But then that comes, April 19th comes, and they're just like chilling across town from their lab. And then the only way for them to fix it is to get back to their lab and get into the chair and like restart the timeline. So right. Literally there's a big action set piece where it's like they have to get across town while bombs are dropping.
Right.
And they have to like get through these cars, and they're like running to get back to the chair. It's like, motherfucker, why didn't you just spend the day in the lab? Why
right,
what are you
be with
doing
the chair.
Like on a hike?
Yeah. Right.
And it was just, it's like so transparent that it's like, this is 100% filler. This doesn't make any sense. Literally, these people have spent 40 years living for this moment, and they're 10 miles away.
Right.
So that was kind of frustrating.
How did you come to that book?
That was a book that our book group chose.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I think my wife actually chose it, and she read, he has another book called Dark Matter that she really liked.
Okay.
And then that's his new book. She'd read a bit of it, And the first half is pretty compelling, and the second half is kind of dog shit.
Gotcha. The old compelling dog shit routine.
Right. That's how they get you, the 1-2 punch. You've already bought the book. That's the
selling point.
You're not going to read more than half of it before you buy it. And then the other thing, I guess, have you watched The Expanse?
No.
Or read The Expanse?
No, but I remember you talking about it in previous episodes.
I saw the TV show, and I bought the book, but I didn't actually start reading it.
All right. So if you want to feel bad about
yourself. Well, I saw the first season of the TV show.
So the books that those are based on have been coming out one a year since 2010. I think they just came out with the 9th one, and the 10th one is coming out probably this Christmas.
Is that the one by James S. and A. Corey?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so if you want to feel bad about your work output over the last 10 years, so that's two guys that write those books, and those books are like 700-pound beasts. And in addition, one of those guys, in addition to writing one of those books every year for the last 10 years, has also been writing two separate fantasy series that are each...
Wow. Do you think they have like five teams? Books.
Maybe, but I mean, I think like... I don't know. Like how they do all effective. The plotting
and then they have people fill it in.
I don't know how effective it would be I think they just write a shitload. Because I mean, so I think over... So this guy started this fantasy series called The Dagger and the Coin in like 2007 or something. And there's five books in that one. And then he has another one called something else that I didn't read. But The Dagger and the Coin is the one I read. And that's actually pretty good. Shockingly good. Especially for somebody who's writing like a book and a half a year.
Right.
And it's about, kind of as the title implies, it's about a war that's happening. And also the main character works for a bank. So it's like about the bank's role in the war. And the war is against these priests that can always tell if you're telling the truth, which kind of initially seems like it would be helpful and then turns out to be disastrous.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm extremely surprised by how good that guy's writing is for writing what I'm guessing is something like 1,000 words a day every single day for the last 20 years.
Right. Well, there's something too, if you get, those are all continuing series, right? So they're all kind of continuing the same world. I wonder if the part of it is getting to a groove with when you know your characters, you know your world, you know the backstory, you can kind of groove along with it versus having to spend so much time trying to conjure up those worlds and characters every single time you write a new novel.
It's certainly easier to write 20 books in three different series than it is to write 20 individual books.
Yeah, but, totally. I mean,
dude's still written 20 books.
Yeah, that's still a ton of output, for sure.
It's crazy. Especially for being, I think one of them, one of the James S. or A. Corey guys is George R. R. Martin's, or was his assistant.
Oh, really?
And that's kind of how he first got his book looked at or something. But,
right.
I mean... Yeah, talk about two different work ethics.
Can you give me a one-sentence pitch on The Expanse? Either the show or the books. What is it about?
It's about like Firefly if the politics were more realistic.
Okay.
So it's very space opera. It's very like six-man crew on a boat flying around, but the politics are much more difficult. And it's a lot more like, so the captain in The Expanse is similar to, have you guys seen Firefly? Is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's very similar in character to Malcolm Reynolds, the Firefly captain, but everybody else around him treats him like he's a child, like a naive child that needs to grow up. And he keeps doing these like cowboy things that kind of work out and kind of fuck everybody else's shit up. Right. And then like he fucks like Earth-Mars relations. And they're like, why the fuck did you do that? And he's like, well, but I was just telling people the truth. And they're like, yeah, don't stop. Like, you're fucking everything up. Right. So it's interesting for that. I mean, it's not going to change your life, but it's I think it's some of the best space opera fiction that there is. Going actively.
Yeah, you hear lots about it. I mean, I feel like it's people on Twitter are constantly talking about the show and the books together.
Yeah.
So I've heard a lot about it, but I could never quite distill like what is this show actually or book actually about. So that makes more sense. That's interesting. Maybe I'll pick it up.
Great audiobooks because they're each like fucking 25 hours long. They're the perfect kind of audiobooks where you can kind of dip in and out and you don't need to constantly be paying attention.
Right.
bang, nice. Bang for your buck, for sure.
Yeah, totally. I've got a couple things. One is a follow-up from the last What Are We Reading episode. We talked about Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano. At the time, I had just started reading it. I think I was maybe 100 pages in, maybe less than that. And I loved it, but was kind of, if I recall, my response to the book was still a bit uncertain, or I was having trouble with it. I finished it in that time, and I loved it. It was a fantastic reading experience. Maybe one of the best reading experiences I can recall in several years. It's a very complex novel. I couldn't begin to tell you what it all means. There's a lot going on. It's about colonialism. It's about politics and race and Englishness and decline of Englishness, maybe. But it's also about, I don't know, much more than that. It's really a thrilling book.
Is it
but not thrilling in terms of exciting. Was it?
Is it a big book?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, my volume, I think, was like around 400, maybe, something like that, 450, 500. But the reading is very slow because the sentences are very long and the description is very intense. Huh. It's not easy to parse the language, so it requires some concentration.
So what...
The story...
Sorry, what is it about? Like, when does it take place?
I want to say right before World War II, I think, maybe.
Okay.
Or possibly right after. I can't remember the exact time frame. I know that's important and I just have forgotten.
Mexico, right?
It's in Mexico, yeah. So the... It takes place over the course of one day. It's set in one day. It's similar to Ulysses in that sense. It's three characters: the consul, his estranged wife Yvonne, and then his brother Hugh, and kind of how they confront each other through that day. So Yvonne has come back to the city where the consul used to work. He's sort of a disgraced and former consul now, to try and rekindle their marriage and give it one last shot. His brother Hugh is there kind of as a way station on various political and military misadventures. The consul is an alcoholic, an inveterate alcoholic who is struggling to keep his life together through the sort of haze of mezcal and various other liquors. And they just deal with stuff. There's memory, there's drinking, there's wandering in the city, there's a trip. The main plot is a trip to a different city where they encounter a series of misfortunes, basically. The ending is devastatingly sad. And the reason I read this book in the first place was way back in the feed, if you go back and listen, it might have been a Patreon episode, actually, there was a game we played about famous endings of novels. And one of the famous endings that I had found for that Emi game was The Last Night of Under the Volcano, which was a dead dog was thrown into the ditch after him or something along those lines. Huh. And I was just compelled by the idea of what could that possibly be? Like, it was such a shocking or startling final line. And so learning how that comes to be and sort of what takes place to get to that point was really interesting. I recommend it to everyone. I know that Dave had it recommended to him recently from a different source, and I can't stress it enough how good it is. I'm just encourage you to check it out if you want to devote some really sort of chunky reading time to a pretty dense and difficult but ultimately satisfying text. It was a book that I finished, but I kept in my backpack for about 2 weeks afterwards, so I couldn't let it go. I wasn't reading it, but I felt like I couldn't put it down or didn't want to put it on my shelf. I couldn't quite part with it yet, which is, I hadn't felt that way in a long time.
Yeah.
And then another book that I had a very strong emotional reaction to is an author known around these parts. This is Stuart Onan, a novel called Songs for the Missing. We read Stuart Onan's novella Last Night at the Lobster a couple episodes back in the feed, if you want to listen for that one. And I'd read his novel East of Eden. No, sorry, West of Sunset before.
Very different. Boy.
Yeah, just right in the brain. And we all kind of, I want to say, discovered Stuart Onan together, kind of. I think we all kind of felt like his writing really opened up in a surprising way. So I checked this out. I saw it at a used bookstore and just grabbed it on a whim. I had not heard of it. Well, there's actually a funny story behind that. Dave read a different Stuart Onan novel called Songs for the Something, or it's got a similar title, and he recommended that to me. And I thought I was picking up that, but I was not, because they have just very, very similar titles. I can't remember what the title of that one is now, but I'm sure Dave will tell us in a future episode. This is a novel about a missing girl, teenager, 18-year-old girl goes missing in the summer before she goes to college. And it's about the search for her and what happens to her family as the result of that. It sounds pretty conventional. It sounds not unlike The Lovely Bones in terms of plot. And it's actually the realistic alternative to The Lovely Bones, if you're looking for something a bit more concrete than that is sort of surreal or phantasmagorical. I will say I didn't love this book for 90% of it. I read it, and it read relatively quickly, but it wasn't a passion read necessarily. And then the last 20 pages hooked me in, or something happened in the last 20 pages. I don't want to spoil it for anybody because it's worth reading on your own. And when I read it, I sobbed. I was crying really hard for a long time, because it was the culmination of all this emotional stuff that kind of just had simmered in the background, I guess, or I had been absorbing and processing. But when it culminated in a very surprising and, I don't know, thoughtful way, it really hit. Stuart Onan's a writer who I think is, I've come to learn, is very subtle and careful in that regard. So even a book that I didn't think was anything special ended up having this really massive punch that I was not prepared for. The only thing I'll say about it in terms of structure that was really striking is that it sort of unfolds in this really interesting pace where the first half, you know, covers a couple days of the investigation, maybe even a couple weeks, a very sort of slow pace, like hours by hours, sometimes even, you know, minute by minute. By the end, you're leaping forward weeks, months at a time, which reflects the frustration of a search like that when it stretches on for a long time. The reality of missing persons cases is that after that initial sort of whir of activity, it kind of dies down. And when there's no leads, there's no sort of compelling cases, it just kind of turns into a file in a police department or a detective's, you know, docket or something like that. So that pace can be frustrating because it sort of goes so gradually and then kind of speeds up, but there's nothing really happens with the case. You're frustrated by that, but so much is happening along with that, with the family members and so forth, that it's never a bore. It never slacks in that regard. Yeah, I recommend, maybe with a caution on that one, that it won't be your favorite book, but really did get me in the end.
Hmm.
I recall tweeting to the Nakibia's Twitter account, they should name this guy Stuart O'Man, what a good writer, because he is. I also read The Friend by Sigrid Nunez. We'll talk about that in a different episode because we have Brick has some stuff to say about it, so does Dave. We'll sort of get into that. Well, that'll do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good fiction. You can follow us on Twitter at YakBabies, and you can email us at YakBabiesPodcast@gmail.com. But you should definitely go to patreon.com/YakBabies and join our Patreon. It costs you $1. The incentive is very low. So a single dollar gives you access to all our episodes. There's bonus stuff happening on Patreon that is not in the main feed. So things happen during these recordings that are not for casual ears, let's say. If you want to be a YakBabies insider, if you feel like you're cool enough, then go pay us that dollar.
Personal pal.
Yes, if you want to be a personal pal like us, like Nico, like Brick, like Dave, myself, and get access to the weird and woolly stuff on the Patreon, go there, check it out, and listen and enjoy. Until then, Yak Babies yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to send an extra thank you to everyone who listens regularly, and especially to those who have supported on Patreon, past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, and William Howard Taft.
Sight. Find the place where I
Oh.